And at the top of the hour, as always, we want to wish happy birthday to a few of our Iris listeners today. Barb and I say happy birthday to Mary Clark of Ankeny, Henry Skip Froling of Sheldahl, and Marlene Marsh of Mason City. Again, happy birthday to Mary Clark of Ankeny, Henry Skip Froling of Sheldahl, and Marlene Marsh of Mason City. A few celebrity birthdays today, and the Register now, rather than listing their age, is giving their date of birth, so we're going to have to do the math in our minds. I'll leave that up to you. Actor-comedian Eric Idle of Monty Python was born in 1943. Actor-comedian Amy Sedaris, born in 1961. Actor Lucy Lawless, 1968. TV radio journalist Lara Logan was born in 1971. So happy birthday to all of them as well. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you're hearing us on your television over Iowa PBS and you're not yet a registered IRIS user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so we can get you on our birthday list. We need to know who's listening in order to keep our services free to you. So now we'll turn it back to Barb for a look at the obituaries in today's Register.
And we have two. In Des Moines, Beverly Jean Formaro Snyder Wessel was born August 13 of 1937 and passed away on March 25th, 2024, surrounded by her family. Memorial events include Saturday, March 30th, a visitation from 9 to 11, and a funeral service at 11 at Merle Hay Funeral Home, 4400 Merle Hay Road. The interment will be at Glendale Cemetery, and a luncheon will follow. Then Sister Jeanette Copel, Mary Renee, CHM, 90, died at Bishop Drum Retirement Center in Johnston, Iowa, on March 26, 2024, and she has donated her body for medical research. Memorial Vespers will be at 4 p.m. Tuesday, April 2nd in Our Lady of Peace Chapel at Bishop Drum in Johnston. Also Tuesday, April 2nd in the Magnificat Chapel at the Humility of Mary Center, there will be a rosary held at 4 p.m. and a memorial vigil service will happen at 7 p.m.
And moving to a story in the online edition of today's Register, a former state lawmaker's lawsuit against the Des Moines Police Department over a 2020 protest arrest can go to trial. This story by William Morris of the Des Moines Register. A former Iowa Assistant Attorney General who was tackled and arrested by Des Moines police during the 2020 George Floyd protests can take his lawsuit against the officers to trial, a federal judge has ruled. Paxton Williams, who at the time represented the state in tax cases, joined a protest march to the Iowa Capitol on June 1st of 2020. He said he later returned to the entryway of his East Village apartment building and watched the ongoing confrontations between police and alleged rioters from there. As described in court filings, police officers approached the doorway and ordered him to move. He alleges Des Moines police officer Jacob Headland then tackled and used pepper spray on him without giving him a chance to submit to arrest voluntarily. He was cited for failure to disperse and spent the night in the Polk County Jail. Prosecutors later dismissed the citation. Williams, who now works in private practice, sued the city in 2022, alleging that he was arrested without probable cause and subjected to excessive force in violation of the Iowa and U.S. constitutions. The city of Des Moines asked the court to grant summary judgment and dismiss all the claims, arguing both the arrest and the use of force were justified given the riot conditions around them and that the officers were protected by a state law shielding officials from liability for actions taken in response to an emergency. In his order on Wednesday, federal magistrate judge Stephen Jackson granted the city judgment on a number of claims, but not all. It should be up to a jury, Jackson ruled, to decide whether Headland's actions constituted excessive force in violation of the Fourth Amendment's protections from unreasonable searches and seizures, or whether he committed assault and battery, or intentionally inflicted emotional distress under Iowa law. The city did not respond to a request for comment. Williams, via his attorneys, told the Register that, "I appreciate the court's thoughtful ruling and look forward to a jury's resolution of the issues that remain." On the question of excessive force, Judge Jackson found that there are genuine factual disputes about what Williams was saying and doing before he was pepper sprayed and tackled, and whether Officer Hedlund's actions were justified. Judge Jackson wrote, "In the court's view, the body camera video of the interaction between Officer Hedlund and Williams supports certain portions of both parties' assertions and undermines other portions of both parties' assertions. Resolution of those disputed facts requires assessment of credibility and weighing of all the evidence." For the same reason, the judge wrote, it must be left to a jury to decide whether Officer Hedlund's actions were objectively unreasonable so as to constitute an assault and battery under Iowa law. And on Paxton Williams' claim of infliction of emotional distress, Judge Jackson ruled for the city, as to most of the officials named, but found that reasonable men may differ as to whether Hedlund's use of force was sufficiently extreme and outrageous to result in liability. He reserved that claim for jurors to decide as well. Paxton Williams argued that police lacked cause to arrest him for failure to disperse or violating the 9 p.m. curfew imposed by Polk County during the protests. Judge Jackson disagreed, finding that whether Williams was on a public sidewalk or in a privately owned entryway outside the building, it is indisputable that he was not in his home as required by the curfew, and that Officer Hedlund also reasonably perceived Williams had refused repeated instructions to disperse. Jackson also dismissed claims against the officer who wrote Williams' citation, despite several inaccuracies it contained, finding that she reasonably relied on information she received from other officers. And an internal affairs officer who interviewed Williams about his subsequent complaint and whom Williams perceived as trying to intimidate him cannot be held liable because there's no evidence that he took retaliatory adverse actions against Williams, according to the judge. Also tossed out were claims for false arrest, malicious prosecution, and numerous claims for alleged violations of the Iowa Constitution. The court ruling allowing Williams' lawsuit to go to trial is the latest in a series of setbacks for the city of Des Moines in defending its police officers' conduct during the 2020 protests. At least seven lawsuits filed by several dozen plaintiffs have accused Des Moines police of misconduct in their response to protesters. One already has gone to trial, resulting in a partial jury verdict against the city and eventually a $150,000 settlement. Other cases on appeal after federal courts rejected the city's motions for summary judgment. In one case, the city has asked the U.S. Supreme Court to review an appellate court ruling that officers who tackled and pepper sprayed a freelance photographer were not entitled to immunity. The city has won dismissal or agreed to settlements for minimal amounts to resolve several other cases, including claims from a group of men arrested outside the East Village's Blazing Saddle Bar while providing first aid to protesters.
Administration issues new rules on use of AI. By Joey Garrison, Washington, D.C. The Biden administration on Thursday announced three new policies to guide the federal government's use of artificial intelligence, billing the standards as a model for global action on a rapidly evolving technology. The policies, which build off of an executive order President Joe Biden signed in October, come amid growing concerns about risks posed by AI to the U.S. workforce, privacy, and national security, and for potential discrimination in decision-making. The first, the White House's Office of Management and Budget, will require that federal agency ensure the use of AI does not endanger the rights and safety of Americans. Also, to improve transparency, the federal agencies will have to publish online a list of AI systems that they are using, as well as assessment of the risks that those systems might pose and how the risks are being managed. Another, the White House is also directing all federal agencies to designate a chief AI officer with a background in the technology to oversee the use of AI technology within the agency. Vice President Kamala Harris announced the rules in a call with reporters, saying the policies were shaped by input from the public and private sectors, computer scientists, civil rights leaders, legal scholars, and business leaders. Quote, President Biden and I intend that these domestic policies will serve as a model for global action, said Harris, who has helped lead the administration's effort on AI and outlined U.S. initiatives on AI during a global summit in London last November. All leaders from government, civil society, and the private sector have a moral, ethical, and societal duty to make sure that artificial intelligence is adopted and advanced in a way that protects the public from potential harm, while ensuring everyone is able to enjoy its full benefit, Harris said. The federal government has disclosed more than 700 examples of content and play and planned AI use across the agencies. The Defense Department alone has more than 685 unclassified AI projects, according to the nonpartisan Congressional Research Service. Disclosures from other agencies show AI is being used to document suspected war crimes in Ukraine, to test whether coughing into a smartphone can detect COVID-19 in asymptomatic people, and to stop fentanyl smugglers from crossing the southern border, rescue children being sexually abused, and find illegal rhinoceros horns in airplane luggage, among other uses. To assess the safety risks of AI, the federal agencies by December will be required to implement safeguards to reliably assess, test, and monitor AI's impacts on the public, mitigate risks of algorithmic discrimination, and publicize how the government is using AI. Harris said that, for example, if the Veterans Administration wants to use AI in VA hospitals to help doctors diagnose patients, it would need to show the AI system does not produce racially biased diagnoses. Biden's AI executive order, by invoking the Defense Production Act, requires companies developing the most advanced AI platforms to notify the government and share the results of safety tests.
Baltimore Bridge salvage work begins. Four construction workers are still missing after the crash. This story by USA Today, Dateline Baltimore. Authorities on Thursday forged ahead with a salvage operation to remove the mangled bridge and wreckage from the Patapsco River before recovering the bodies of four construction workers and clearing the waterway so the Port of Baltimore, a critical East Coast shipping artery, can resume operations. A crew repairing potholes on the bridge Tuesday morning was on a break when a massive shipping vessel lost power and smashed into the Francis Scott Key Bridge, causing it to collapse in seconds. Eight workers were plunged into the frigid water. Two survived, and officials said the others were presumed dead by Tuesday evening. On Wednesday, rescuers found the bodies of two men trapped in a red pickup around the bridge's middle span. Maryland State Police Superintendent Colonel Richard L. Butler said at a news conference, the workers were from Mexico, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. Maryland Governor Wes Moore on Thursday gave his condolences to the families of the victims and addressed the immense collaboration between local, state, and federal authorities to clear the wreck and open the port. The piles of wreckage in the water, as well as the 984-foot-long cargo ship, the Dolly, forced authorities to shut down the Port of Baltimore, which handles more cars and farm equipment than any other port in the nation. New York Governor Kathy Hochul said Thursday that the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey can take on additional cargo that's being diverted from the Port of Baltimore. A National Transportation Safety Board team on Wednesday boarded the freighter to begin interviewing the ship's two pilots and 21 crew members who remained on the vessel. Investigators also began reviewing information from the ship's voyage data recorder, including radio traffic between the pilot and shore-based authorities leading up to the disaster. The pilot was heard calling for tugboat assistance several minutes before the crash, the first indication of distress to harbor officials, followed by a radio report that the ship had lost all power and was approaching the bridge. Video footage that captured the accident show that the ship's lights were blinking on and off, then they blinked back on briefly before the vessel's lights go out again. The NTSB said recorder data was consistent with a power outage, but that an actual blackout had yet to be confirmed. The recorder also picked up commands to the crew to drop anchor, presumably aimed at slowing the vessel. Safety Board investigator Marcel Muse said data showed the Dali measuring about 3 football fields in length and piled high with shipping containers was moving at about 8 miles per hour when it struck a bridge abutment. Hammondy said that the bridge, while deemed to be in satisfactory condition from its most recent inspection in 2023, was constructed in such a way that failure of one structural member would likely cause a portion of or the entire bridge to collapse. The Dali underwent routine engine maintenance at the port before it set out on its weeks-long journey to Sri Lanka, according to U.S. Coast Guard Rear Admiral Shannon Gilreth at a news conference on Wednesday. Gilreth said the Coast Guard was not informed of any issues with the vessel or its engine. The 9-year-old container ship was involved in at least one prior accident before it crashed into the bridge. In 2016, the Dali struck a landing pier made of stone while leaving port in Antwerp, causing damage to the ship's stern, according to thevesselfinder.com, a site that tracks ships across the world. An investigation found the ship's master and pilot had made a mistake and were to blame. The ship required repair and a full inspection before returning to service. During an inspection in June, officials discovered a deficiency with the Dali's propulsion and auxiliary machinery, gauges, thermometers, etc., according to the Tokyo MOU, an intergovernmental maritime authority in the Asia-Pacific region. On Tuesday, the Dali was carrying the cargo of Maersk, the major shipping company that chartered it. The ship is operated by charter vessel company Synergy Group and owned by Singapore-based Grace Ocean PTE. The bridge collapse could cost insurers billions of dollars in claims, analysts say, and one put the toll as much as $4 billion, which would make the tragedy a record shipping insurance loss. According to Marcos Alvarez, Managing Director for Global Insurance Ratings at Morningstar, he said depending on the length of the blockage and the nature of the business interruption coverage for the Port of Baltimore, insured losses could total between $2 billion and $4 billion. That would surpass the record insured losses of the Costa Concordia luxury cruise liner disaster in 2012. Matilda Jacobson, Senior Director of Analytics at insurance ratings agency AM Best, said the claims would likely run into the billions of dollars. Barb?
Federal collection of race data is getting an overhaul, by Nadita Bose, Washington. The White House on Thursday announced new standards for collecting federal data on race and ethnicity, a decision that will touch organizations that receive federal funding, determine how congressional districts are drawn, and whether equal employment policies can be enforced. The standards from the White House's Office of Management and Budget, revised for the first time since 1997, requires federal agencies to use one combined question for race and ethnicity, encourages respondents to select multiple options on how they identify, and adds Middle Eastern or North African as a new identification category. The move underscores the government's attempt to catch up with modern views of racial and ethnic identities in the United States and shows how federal officials are attempting to capture the complexities of a country that has grown more multiracial. The data they collect is expected to have far-reaching consequences on the U.S. Census, the enforcement of the Voting Rights Act, Fair Housing Act, and other anti-discrimination laws. Our focus here really is on how do we ensure that we have high-quality federal data on race and ethnicity, a senior OMB official said. The official added the new standards will identify different impacts on individuals, programs and services, health outcomes, employment outcomes, educational outcomes. The official declined to identify the federal programs that this will affect. The standards were first proposed under former President Barack Obama, but were subsequently delayed under former President Donald Trump. Since 1997, the U.S. government has distilled the terms such as white, black, and Hispanic into standardized definitions that have stayed the same since then. This established a baseline for federal surveys that ask people to self-report their racial and ethnic identities. The officials said the decisions were based on the findings of a working group which comprised of staff from 35 federal agencies, more than 20,000 public comments, and 94 listening sessions. The new standards will not impact the issue of repayment for slavery or reparations, the collection of data from Black Americans to determine those who descended from enslaved people requires more research, the official said.
And now we'll turn to the USA Today, a roundup of 50 states, and we'll start with the states surrounding Iowa. These are brief mentions from the various USA Today newspapers around America. In Springfield, Illinois, a new bill would strengthen child labor laws in Illinois, including providing more protections and provisions for people 16 and under. In Kansas, the Kansas Senate passed a bill criminalizing organized retail crime, a form of organized theft from a retailer for the purpose of reselling the stolen items. Up in Owatonna, Minnesota, on Tuesday night, Democratic Governor Tim Walz delivered a relatively brief State of the State address at Owatonna High School. The former teacher used a 23-minute speech to champion DFL trifecta achievements, drawing contrast from other states and urging legislators to pass legislation about gun control. To the south in Springfield, Missouri, talk of replacing the city's 3/4-cent police fire pension sales tax with a new tax this year or next has been ongoing at the Springfield City Council, though without much consensus. To ensure the community has a voice in the conversation and the process moves along efficiently, the City of Springfield Mo is creating a new Citizens Commission on Community Investment to research needs and potential uses and craft a recommendation for the City Council. Over in Omaha, Nebraska, Mayor Jean Stothert announced that she will run for a fourth term in 2025, according to the Omaha World Herald. And where have we not touched? To the northeast, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. A seventh grader is suing her school district for barring her from the girls' bathroom because she's transgender, according to a lawsuit filed in federal court in Milwaukee. Her attorneys say the Elkhorn Area School District violated Title IX. That's a federal law that prohibits discrimination based on gender or sex in schools. Barb?
Oh, I will continue here with a few of these 50 states, a little more far-flung. Rhode Island, Providence, let's see. There aren't enough subsidized rentals for the 49,468 lowest-income households in Rhode Island, leaving half of them without viable housing options, according to a national report on low-income housing. And then in Nashville, Tennessee, the Department of Education there has updated its school and district report cards, and parents can use the one-stop shop to find how their school ranks and what types of students it serves and whether it's improving academically. Okay. Austin, Texas. Continue to push for changes at the Austin Police Department's Cadet Academy. Outside consultants say that more work remains to reach the goals established each year. Dave?
Well, that will wrap up our first 90 minutes together. Your readers have been Barb Martin and Dave Buzik. It's been our pleasure, as always, to read for you on Friday mornings. Now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get in place. We hope you have a wonderful weekend and a good Easter.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Jim Hoffman and my name is Rachel Mithelman. We'll continue with articles from the Des Moines Register now and USA Today. And here is Jim with our next article.
Thanks, Rachel. Good morning, everyone. We're in the USA Today opinion page, and we have columnist Rex Hupke, who we listen to every once in a while, and he has an opinion piece, Bridge Tragedy Exposes Sad Conspiracy Nuts. As news of the tragic collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore unfolded, I was on the road in the Midwest getting information the old-fashioned way, via the radio. Not from the viperous din of talk radio, not from pruned for your particular ideology satellite radio stations, just regular straight news radio updates from normal sources like the Associated Press or CNN. What I learned as the day rolled along was simple. A massive cargo ship lost power early Tuesday and issued a mayday call before hitting one of the bridge's supports. The collision caused the bridge to collapse. The warning allowed authorities to shut down traffic on the bridge, likely saving many lives. 6 construction workers who were filling potholes were missing and presumed dead at the time. Local, state, and federal officials rightly praised first responders and search and rescue crews. There was no sign or speculative nonsense, just vital information on a truly sad day. The bridge collapse was an awful accident, one that will be further investigated. The loss of lives was heartbreaking. The government response seemed focused and well-coordinated. When I got home, I looked to see the day's news had unfolded on social media, particularly on the site formerly known as Twitter. My immediate response was, "What in the name of all that is holy is going on here?" A deadly accident with a simple explanation had, in the time that it takes to say unhinged cookery, had been grotesquely transformed into a conspiratorial weapon aimed at everything from the border crisis to diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. What existed online regarding the Baltimore Bridge collapse, stuff beamed into the brains of millions, bore no resemblance to what I had learned. Excuse me. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican from Georgia, posted on social media, "Is this an intentional attack or an accident?" A widely circulated Fox News clip showed Maria Bartiromo noting that officials have said there was nothing nefarious behind the bridge collapse. Then in the same breath, talking about the potential for wrongdoing or potential for foul play, given the wide open border. A right-wing figure on Newsmax, in a clip shared widely on the site formerly known as Twitter, opined ludicrously, "I'm no expert on what's going on in the seas, but all I would say is that if you talk to employers in America, they'll tell you that filling slots with employees who aren't drug-addled is a very huge problem." What that has to do with a ship crewed entirely by Indian nationals is beyond me, but okay. A right-wing social media figure with nearly 140,000 followers claim the company that operated the ship promotes diversity, equity, and inclusion. Then later posed the thoughtful question, did DEI cause this collapse? No, but that is the dumbest question anyone has ever asked, so congratulations on that. Another right-wing X-user, this one with more than 250,000 followers, posted a clip of Baltimore Mayor Brandon Scott, who is black, speaking about the tragedy, identifying him as Baltimore's DEI mayor. Rabidly pro-Donald Trump, far-right conspiracy theorist Jack Posoblek posted a picture of the collapsed bridge with this comment, "At least your grandchildren will know you fought racism." The juxtaposition between the opportunistic hot gas bubbles emitted from the fetid swamps of social media and the normal human being news I listened to while driving was, to put it lightly, staggering. As someone who often follows the news as it breaks on social media, I was reminded that things look different up here in the air most people breathe. 18th century English poet Thomas Gray wrote of being far from the madding crowd's ignoble strife. That's where I was, a place where things make more sense, where facts matter, where there can be a simple explanation to a horrific happening, and people don't pounce on every tragedy to make a buck or raise their profile. There's a long-standing saying on what used to be Twitter, "Twitter isn't real life." under Elon Musk's radical pro-conspiracy ownership, that has become truer than ever. It's a cesspool. It's a den of racism and bigotry and xenophobia that has become virtually fact-resistant. The Baltimore Bridge collapse demonstrated that in no uncertain terms, what happened far from the madding crowd, what happened in real life, was wholly different from what the cranks and hatred addicts chirped about online. My hope as this election year plods on is that more people are living a real life than one of ignoble strife, and that the clowns and dirtbags trumpeting conspiracies to the masses on X are left to reckon with their own sad impotence.
The second piece on the USA Today opinion page today is titled Beyoncé's Album Calls Out Country Music's Silent Racism. It's written by Andrea Williams, who's an opinion columnist for The Tennessean. On March 19th, Beyoncé took to Instagram to announce the 10-day countdown to the release of her highly anticipated country album, Cowboy Carter. In the announcement, she also revealed the personal reasons behind her full-length foray into country music. She wrote, "This album has been over 5 years in the making. It was born out of an experience that I had years ago where I did not feel welcomed, and it was very clear that I wasn't." It didn't take long to connect the dots between Beyoncé's statement and her 2016 appearance at the Country Music Association Awards. Alongside the Dixie Chicks, now known as the Chicks, Beyoncé ripped through a heart-stomping rendition of Daddy Lessons that was equal parts funky and folksy. But the story, the one that exploded across the internet and captured the attention of people far outside of Nashville, was less about the performance itself and more about the country music industry's reaction to it. The day after the show, Travis Tritt, one of the most successful country artists of the 1990s, took to Twitter and asserted that, quote, "We can stand on our own and don't need pop artists on our awards shows," end of quote. He later backtracked a bit, stating that his complaint wasn't Beyoncé-specific and that he had long bemoaned sharing country stages with non-country artists. But his question, "I want to know when the BET or Soul Train Awards are going to ask a country artist to perform on their awards show," seemed particularly pointed. Finally, there was the speculation that veteran country artist Alan Jackson walked out while Beyoncé was on stage. The speculation was confirmed by Chris Willman, a senior music writer at Variety who was then writing for Billboard, and spoke to an unnamed Nashville manager about the Beyoncé Chicks collaboration. The manager said, "I think it was a flat performance overall, and a lot of industry people I have talked with were not impressed for a variety of reasons. The overall show was great, but in my opinion, that seemed out of place and felt forced. I was sitting behind Alan Jackson, and he actually stood up from the front row and walked out in the middle of the performance, so I think that spoke volumes for the traditional, real country acts." What was unknown was how Beyoncé may have been impacted by the backlash. Now, thanks to an Instagram post and a direct reference to criticisms and limitations, the whole world, country music industry included, knows how Beyoncé felt. Like other spaces that cultivate cultures of exclusion, country music thrives in silence. Where there is no accountability, the status quo persists. Meanwhile, allegations from outside the industry are rejected as inaccurate, such as, "Country music isn't racist. Black people just don't like it. They have R&B and rap, so that's why you don't see many of them in the industry." Or, "Why does everything have to be about race all the time?" Or, the favorite, "How can country be racist when we gave you Charlie Pride?" The Pride reference is particularly telling, and not just because it's predictable to point to the most successful black artist in country music history, while ignoring the fact that his commercial peak occurred decades ago. Pride conducted his country music career under the cloak of silence, never publicly pushing back against the system that embraced him at arm's length. He said nothing when Willie Nelson dubbed him Super N, and George Jones spray-painted KKK on his car, dismissing both as jokes from friends. Neither did he make public comment when the Academy of Country Music, considered the more inclusive counterpart to the CMA, didn't award him a single trophy during his run of 29 number one singles. The silence, while counterproductive on a systemic level, is nonetheless understandable. Charlie Pride had been allowed to succeed in Nashville. At any point, the grantors of his good fortune could have revoked it. The same year Beyoncé appeared on the CMH stage, Pride explained his avoidance of difficult conversations. In an interview with the Dallas Observer, Pride said, "I'm not a coward or anything like that, but I think that with the help of my dad and mom, I just learned to find a way around the negative stuff." Notably, that 2016 interview took place 50 years after Pride's debut. The headline, "Will Darius Rucker Break Country Music's Color Barrier Once and For All?" was a stark reminder that no amount of Pride's pacification could have created a more inclusive industry. While the inclination to find a way around the negative stuff is still commonplace in country music, some black creatives have been more open. This was evident after the summer of 2020, when protests for racial equality erupted across the nation and country music industry faced its own reckoning. Even the previously silent Rucker went on the record detailing his need to denounce racism, acknowledging the danger in doing so as a black country artist, and noting that it was no longer okay to stay on the sidelines. These revelations were often met with vitriol. Mickey Guyton, for example, was repeatedly told to leave country music if she thought it was so bad. Perhaps because of this, or the accusations that Guyton was merely an opportunist using racial unrest to build her career. Other black creatives, particularly those less accomplished, chose Pride's path of silence. But we know that for every known slight to black creatives in country music, the lack of black writers signed to publishing deals, the dismal spins for black women at country radio, there are hundreds more unknown. The black touring musician promoted to musical director, then told he can't hire any other black musicians. Or the black artist told by a major label representative that there's nothing we can do for you, only to see the same rep reinvent herself as a diversity advocate years later. It matters then that Beyoncé has called out the industry that still has considerable work to do in its efforts to be truly inclusive. Because while there are still no certainties about the long-term industry impact of Beyoncé's country turn, we know one thing for sure. There were black creatives in country music before Beyoncé, and they will remain long after she's gone. In speaking out, Beyoncé represents but one voice. But her voice is louder than most, its ability to cut through the industry's vacuum of accountability far more pronounced. If nothing else, though, if country music continues to maintain the barriers preventing black creatives from building sustainable careers, Zora Neale Hurston's words remain true. If you're silent about your pain, they'll kill you and say you enjoyed it.
Thank you, Rachel. Turning to sports, and we have the TV schedules to let you know about. There's some hockey on this evening, 6 o'clock on the National Hockey League Network, New Jersey at Buffalo. NBA basketball, 6 o'clock. We have the Lakers at Indiana, and then at 9 o'clock, the Dallas at Sacramento, those both on NBA TV. And, of course, the dominant thing is the men and women's college basketball, NCAA tournaments. And for the men, they start tonight at 6:09 on CBS with North Carolina State against Marquette. And then at 6:39 on TBS, Gonzaga versus Purdue. At 8:39 CBS, the second game will be Duke and Houston. And then at 9:09, the second game on TBS, Creighton and Tennessee. And then we'll have the Final Four coming up. Women's college basketball, we have at 1:30 this afternoon on ESPN, Oregon State plays Notre Dame. At 4 o'clock, ESPN, Indiana plays South Carolina, number one. At 6:30, ESPN, North Carolina State plays Stanford, and at 9 o'clock, Gonzaga plays Texas. So we're making progress on the women's side as well. And Major League Baseball today, 5:30, Major League Baseball Network. We have Toronto at Tampa Bay, and this is the real season now. And at 6:10, Pittsburgh at Miami. Then at 7:10 on Apple TV Plus, the Yankees against Houston. And at 9:10 on Apple TV Plus, St. Louis at the L.A. Dodgers. Small article here, but important for those of us in Iowa. Dort Women's Basketball claims NAIA national title. On Tuesday, the Dort Women's Basketball team won the NAIA national title with a 57-53 victory over Providence College out of Montana. It was a defensive battle as the defenders were held to their second lowest point total of the season, while Providence scored 15 points below its season average. Carly Gustafson finished off her career with a team-high 15 points for Dort. Janie Schoenhoven was clutch down the stretch, scoring 12 of her 14 total points in the second half. On the night, Dort shot 37.7% from the field compared to Providence's 36.4%. The defenders struggled mightily from beyond the arc, hitting on just one three-pointer out of seven attempted. But they thrived at the charity stripe. Dort made it to the line 24 times in the game and converted on 16 of those shots, 67.6%. Bailey Beckman, who finished the night with 8 points, hit four straight free throws with time ticking down to make the lead insurmountable and clinched the title. The defenders finished this season with a 35-2 record. It marks just the second national title in the athletic department's history, following a men's cross-country national title in 2022.
And a few short pieces before we go to Dear Abby in a few minutes. This from columnist Randy Peterson, who has been with the Register for decades and is retiring soon. First, there's an editorial note. Note to readers, Iowa State columnist Randy Peterson wrote this piece for the Des Moines Register.com readers on Thursday afternoon from Des Moines. The Iowa State men's basketball team was set to play Illinois later Thursday in a Sweet 16 game in Boston. Then what Randy wrote, my forever goal since starting at the Des Moines Register in 1972 and finishing in a few weeks, has been to cover a team in college basketball's Final Four. This week's path toward that goal, as you may have heard, took a hiatus. I fought through an illness, not COVID, during last weekend's rounds of 64-32 against South Dakota State and Washington State. Only a few, including always dependable Register beat writer Travis Hines, outside of my family, knew. Then, not long after returning from Omaha before dawn last Sunday, I politely asked a daughter to please call me an ambulance, or something like that. Next thing I knew, I was headed to Iowa Methodist and, yes, laptop in tow, a daughter's phrase in one of Tommy Birch's Randy's Retirin' stories. My heart was beating a beat it shouldn't be beating. After a couple of procedures, diagnosing the cause and fixing whatever was wrong, I'll tell you the same thing I told Cyclones coach T.J. Otzelberger during his very nice and repeated checking up on me. I said, I'll hook back up with you guys in Arizona for the Final Four. Randy Peterson is in his 52nd year writing sports for the Des Moines Register. And a couple of transfer notes. Drake men's basketball has lost another player to the transfer portal, true freshman guard Colby Gardland. He confirmed his decision with the Register on Wednesday. The 6'1", 183-pound athlete was a major contributor off the bench for the Bulldogs, averaging 19.5 minutes per game, the most of any non-starter on the roster. He started two games against Alcorn and UAB. Garland averaged 5.7 points, 2.8 rebounds, and 2.3 assists per game. Drake lost several players to the portal after West Virginia announced it had hired Darian DeVries, Drake's former coach, as its new head basketball coach on Sunday night. All four returning starters, Tucker DeVries, Kevin Overton, Aiton Wright, and Connor Enright, entered the portal, and Garland is the fourth bench player to hit the transfer portal. DeVries compiled a 155-loss overall record in six seasons at Drake, including back-to-back Missouri Valley Conference championships and automatic berths to the NCAA tournament in 2023 and 2024. That's the time we have for sports. And now it's time to turn to Dear Abby. Two letters, so each of your readers will take one and the response. Dear Abby, I have a friend who talks nonstop. Honestly, I can put the phone down and go make a cup of tea and she'll still be talking when I get back. I don't think she even takes a breath. I want to tell her she sometimes needs to ask questions or seek the opinions of others. How can I do this without hurting her feelings? She has many good qualities. She's knowledgeable on many topics. She's artistic, and she's a good cook. She is just exhausting to be around. I feel bad for her and her husband. Her children are good, productive citizens, but man, oh man, I dread getting a call from her. Advice? Signed, Overwhelmed in Georgia. Abby writes, Dear Overwhelmed, there's a reason why you are drained after those phone calls. Your friend is a compulsive talker and a sapper. A sapper is someone who gains energy by draining it from others. The next time she calls, have a stopwatch handy and make a note of the length of time she rambles on and on. Then point out that although she may be unaware of it, she talked at you for however number of minutes. Then suggest she dial it back and consider asking an occasional question and including you in the conversation because what she has been doing is exhausting. She may not like what you are saying, but she really needs to hear it. And P.S., consider screening your calls so that if you don't have the energy to talk with the woman, you can avoid listening to her.
And Dear Abby, my husband and I are planning a cruise to celebrate our 30th wedding anniversary as well as his retirement next year. We invited my brother and his wife, Rita, to join us. Because my brother has always wanted to visit our cruise destination, they accepted. Rita then shared our cruise plans with her brother and his wife, Jewel. Jewel expressed interest in the destination and said she wouldn't mind going. In response, Rita welcomed them to join us. When I was told this, Rita said her brother doesn't like cruises and probably wouldn't want to go, so I just let it go. Still, I am annoyed at her presumptuousness. Am I wrong to feel the way I do about her inviting her family without first asking if it was okay with me and my husband? Rita did say she was sorry for inviting them, but I'm still annoyed. I love my brother and sister-in-law, and I'd hate to cause family drama. I'd welcome your thoughts. Signed, Cruising in Hawaii. And Abby writes, Dear Cruising, I agree that what Rita did was presumptuous. It was also thoughtless. She did not have the right to invite anyone along on your holiday. If Jewel tells Rita that she and her husband have decided to come, it will then be Rita's responsibility to straighten the matter out by rescinding the invitation. And you should sweetly make that clear to her.
That brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today, Friday, March 29th. Your readers have been Jim Hoffman, and my name is Rachel Mithelman. Earlier, you heard Barb Martin and Doug Busick. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.